นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังคุณุตตรังอุปัชฌายังนามาสามิ
On one occasion, the Lord Buddha said that the essence of his teachings, the essence of the Dhamma Vinaya, that which unites as a common thread, theme, in all of the 84,000 Dhammakandas or Dhamma teachings, is that of liberation. In a famous simile, he compared it to the taste of the oceans, all the seas of the world. You can taste the water in any sea, any ocean, and it has the same salty taste. Similarly, every single teaching, if it's an authentic Buddhist teaching, has the taste of liberation. So I think it's I found it myself useful to apply this perspective on the teachings. In particular today, I'd like to reflect on how the practice of the Bārami are all practices of liberation, leading to liberation, characterized by liberation. The first of the Bārami, backtrack a little, what are the Bārami? Usually translated as the 10 perfections. And although this group of 10 is not found in the Sutta literature as such, it is of great antiquity and I think a very useful group of dhammas. And I think particularly in the present day, we tend to be content obsessed with content and technique, and to assume that problems can always be solved by technologies and spiritual technologies, information. The assumption is if we're not successful in an endeavor, it's because we lack the necessary information. And that in meditation practice, all we need is some special tip or some secret key, and everything will work out. But I don't think that there is, I have not observed a clear correlation between access to knowledge of techniques and information and success in meditation. And there is a hidden or an unknowable factor, and that is the previous accumulation of Bāramis. So we perhaps might summarize that as being a matter of spiritual maturity. So it's not just that you can develop samatha and develop stability, clarity, alertness in the mind, and you know the techniques of vipassana meditation. If you lack the spiritual maturity, accumulated maturity to integrate those practices, there won't be success. So I think these Bāramis are worthy of study, and that they provide the foundation for long-term and profound growth in the Dhamma. So, returning to the list itself, and the first is a very familiar one, that of dana. So, often dana is perhaps sort of a bit kind of poo-pooed by meditators. You know, we're not to this merit-making stuff very much. We're into the real practice of meditation. But the development of generosity and giving is, if it is carried out correctly, a practice of liberation. We seek to be liberated from stinginess and meanness and attachment to our possessions and our wealth. So when we give without expectation of any reward, then the mind experiences an initial form of liberation, letting go of the burden of attachment to external material things in particular. And through giving, we experience great joy. And there are many lessons that may be learned from observing the mind in the process of giving. The Buddha says successful giving is one in which we take care of our minds both before giving the gift, at the time of giving, and after giving. This is often overlooked. Let's say someone is taking some food to the temple and they get up a bit later than they meant to, and then everything's in a rush, hurrying around, looking at the clock, and it's not going to be around. They get very upset and scrambled, and so they are failing in the practice of merit making and offering of dana in the pre giving phase. Then at time of offering, say offering food to monks, and often people in Thailand will keep a beady eye on the, particularly on the abbot, to see whether he takes some of my food or not. And then if he doesn't, or he takes very little, then their mind can be very clouded and the joy of giving is undermined. Sometimes they go up to the table afterwards and, oh, I got up since 4 o'clock this morning to make that and they haven't taken any of it. So that means like you're not taking care of your mind after giving. So it's a practice of mindfulness in itself, isn't it? To care for your mind before giving, at the moment of giving, and after giving. If you feel regret after giving something away, then you have also reduced the purification of mind that takes place through giving. And the word merit or punya means the purification of mind. So this isn't a theory or a Buddhist concept. It's just something which can be directly experienced very easily. If you compare how your mind feels when you give something with expectation of something in return, and how when you give something without expectation of return, I think there's a significant difference. And the cleansing, brightening effect of giving without expectation is not experienced to any to the same degree at all when there is desire for some return. Now, practice of dana is perhaps one of the practice, we can say, which is most beautifully practiced in Thailand, I would say. My own experience living in Thailand, I'm sure in the West and in monasteries here, there are very generous people, of course. My experiences in Thailand and in Asia, I'll give you an example of the beauty of dana that I experienced myself, not in Thailand, but in India. I was walking around Maharashtra state in western India, on a kind of a loop from the city of Aurangabad through Ellora and Ajanta. And in the night, I would just climb one of the hills adjoining to the side of the road and spend the night. There were a few mosquitoes. It was temperate climate. I didn't need my umbrella, mosquito net, and just put down a mat and cover myself with my robe and sleep just like in the Buddha's time. So one night I climbed up this hill, and I was observed by a couple of goat herds from a nearby village. And I was glad that they didn't come up to bother me. But sometime after dark, already must have been about 9 o'clock at night, there was a scrambling up the hillside. And I was a little bit wary about who could be coming up at that time of night. And eventually, a man appeared over the ridge. And in the dark, he didn't have a torch, flashlight. But what he did have in one of his hands was a big bunch of bananas. And he'd heard I was on this mountainside, and he was afraid I was hungry. And so he'd probably worked a 10 or a 12-hour day. And then after dark, he'd walked from his village a couple of kilometers and climbed up a hill in the dark, sort of hill covered with boulders and quite difficult to climb, to give me a bunch of bananas. So very difficult. I don't speak Marathi, and it's quite difficult to explain that I don't eat in the evening, but eventually managed to convey the information. He was very disappointed, and he left. And then about another hour or two later, quite late night, I heard scrambling, somebody climbing up this hill again. Who could that be late at night? And it was this same man with a blanket. And it's that kind of giving that you experience and you know you'll never forget. I'll never forget that man. For that act of kindness. And I'm sure all of you have acted very kindly in the past. And if you will notice, I think you will see that if you've acted kindly, acted generously in the past, even 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, if you bring the memory of that pure act of generosity to mind, you'll feel bright and joyful. And so the Buddha referred to noble treasures of the heart. And generosity, acts of generosity, are noble treasures of the heart in that they never lose their value. They never become tarnished. That whenever you bring the memory of an act of generosity to mind, your mind becomes bright and clear and happy. So this is what we call merit. And dana is the act of giving, which is one of the first and most powerful forms of making merit. But it is, as I say, also this act of liberation. Just learning how to let go. Learning how to let go of our attachment to possessions, to wealth, to money, creates a habit a habit of letting go, a habit of abandoning attachment, which we can build upon and develop internally when we come to deal with our relationship with negative emotions which we've held on to for a very long time. So I probably have to, if I'm going to get through all 10 of these, I'll probably have to speed up a little bit. The next one, I spoke about this quite a lot last night, is sila. So how is sila a practice of liberation? Well, very clearly, if we voluntarily take upon ourselves certain boundaries for our actions and speech, and we are able to govern our conduct within those boundaries consistently, even on occasions and situations where we're very tempted go beyond those boundaries, then we become liberated from the bad karma which we might otherwise create, but also, and very importantly, we become free from sense of guilt and anguish and self-loathing that accompanies unskillful actions. Now, if we consider the Western concept of self-esteem, would say those first two paramis are the Buddhist answer to how do you create self-esteem. You create self-esteem by governing body and speech within voluntarily accepted boundaries. It has to be voluntary. And secondly, by giving. Because when you give, you are proving to yourself that you can make a positive impact on your family, on your surroundings, your community, the society in which you live in. You can create happiness in others. And by constantly giving, you are strengthening this perception of yourself as someone who can make a difference in the world. It may not be a spectacular difference, but small reductions of suffering in others, small increases in others' happiness and welfare, something that you have created through your act of generosity. This, together with the restraint of sila, creates the sense of self-respect and self-esteem, which is necessary for the more profound levels of Dhamma practice. Now, the third of these paramis is nekamma. Nekamma is is renunciation, and the renunciation of all that is negative and useless and harmful in our lives. That's the first level, and then the more refined level is the renunciation of all that which is trivial and pointless. The nekamma means that leaving the world of sensuality behind, withdrawing from sensuality. And of course, in its advanced form, it may be leaving the world and becoming a monk or a nun. But in everyday terms, it means that we recognize that many sensual pleasures are not forbidden, and they're not necessarily to be completely abjured by lay Buddhists. But from the point of view of Dhamma practice, there the harm lies not in the enjoyment in them. This isn't kind of a Puritan rejection of saying, I enjoy it, therefore it's bad, or I'm bad because I enjoy this. But it's a recognition of a simple psychological truth that if your only access to feelings of well-being is through the sensual world, that you're putting all your eggs in one basket, and you are condemning yourself to a very unstable and fragile experience of happiness and well-being, because the forms and sounds and odors and so on lie outside of our control, and our the body's capacity to enjoy those sensory pleasures is also unstable and unreliable. But psychologically, the point is that if you are involved with, obsessed with the sensual realm, then your mind does not incline towards, it doesn't delight in the non-sensual realm. So it's very simply, if you're in a room of many stories, if you're on the ground floor, you can't be on the first floor or the second floor at the same time. So it's not to say there's anything wrong with the ground floor, but if you would like to see what the view's like from the second floor, then you have to be able to leave the ground floor, at least on certain occasions. In the life of lay Buddhists, it's generally recommended that one takes the 8 precepts on the Upasita day, or on the one prat day. So the 5 precepts is sufficient, an effective standard for body and speech on a daily basis. But by taking 8 precepts, these are the added precepts, are not directly concerned with the avoidance of unwholesome actions per se, but they are precepts of renunciation, to give one a taste and experience of renouncing the non-essential and being able to develop a perspective on our relationship with the world of enjoyment, the sensual realm. Now, on a daily basis, one of the ways we develop nekamma most effectively is the practice of meditation. So if we take a particular object, like the breath, for instance, then this is not an immediately attractive and stimulating object. And that's precisely the point. So the mind, which is addicted to thought, and addicted to memory and imagination, will feel threatened and will struggle and feel very uncomfortable if it has to devote itself to very simple experience of an in-breath and an out-breath. So that is something to be accepted and recognized as a natural reaction of the mind, just as the natural reaction of a wild animal to the attempt to tame it will be struggle. But if we're willing, we see the value of practicing in that way, then we can eventually transcend that kind of addiction. But in the certainly in the initial stages of meditation practice, the mind will gallop off elsewhere. It will seek to refuge in enjoyment, and take refuge in enjoyment of memories and enjoyment of imagination. So sensuality that we are renouncing in meditation is what you like. So sensuality not restricted to the coarser forms of delight and sexual fantasies and so on, But whatever it is that you like, and whatever it is that you like thinking about, and you enjoy dwelling upon, that is the sensual realm that will pull you away from the breath. So, being mindful of the breath means that you're not forgetting it, you're bearing it in mind. But every now and again, then you forget the breath, the mindfulness is lost, and you start, you usually start thinking about something. And recognizing that your mind has wandered is a moment of clear awareness of sampajanya, comprehension that what you're doing now is not what you set out to do. So you wake up, and this is a moment of wakefulness, and then you return to the meditation object. And that return to the meditation object is the practice of Nekamma Parami. It means you're rejecting the sensual world of indulgence and unnecessary enjoyment and returning to the task in hand, returning to the simple, non-exciting reality in the present moment. So many people who meditate get very discouraged when they find that their meditation practice consists basically of keep bringing the mind back, and it goes and you bring it back, and it goes and you bring it back. And you think, I'm not doing this right, or I can't do this properly. But it's exactly that which is the point. You're developing an ability to recognize that the mind has strayed, and you're developing the strength of mind and the renunciation to say, yes, even though I find this quite an enjoyable mental state, quite an enjoyable thought or memory, I'm going to put it down because I aspire to something higher than this. Now often why thoughts, the same thoughts, return again and again is because there is still the delight in them and still the interest in the thought and the mental state. So you bring the mind back, but it's not done wholeheartedly. There's no real sense of renunciation there. There's still a lingering interest and want and a desire to carry on that thought to its conclusion. So after the mind is back with the breath, for no long time at all, it strays back to where it was just now, and it becomes even more frustrated. So maybe just a couple of observations here about dealing with distracting thoughts in meditation. One of them is that there are many strategies to deal with thought. And one of them is if you can't, in your thoughts, you have thoughts of images and words and images, words, images and words. There are different kinds of mental states here. But in the case of words in your mind, if you catch yourself thinking a particular phrase, then the very last word of that phrase can be repeated a few times. So you don't stop your mind thinking at all and come back to the breath, but you consciously repeat the last word of the phrase that you find yourself thinking. And the value of doing that is that you get bored with it. And you put the mind, you put that thought down wholeheartedly. You don't want to think that anymore. You may even find useful to carry on the thought, but try to think more slowly and deliberately, but continually continue the train of thought. And similarly, you'll find that the thought slips away by itself. You lose the interest in it. So if your mindfulness is strong and your commitment is strong, then merely being aware that the mind has strayed that awareness, that awakening of the mind is sufficient for the thought to fall away, to cease by itself. But in the case that the thought, the mental state is more tenacious, and there's more interest in it, and it doesn't just cease by itself, consequent to the moment of awakening, then other strategies may be needed. One is to, as I say, to repeat until one's bored the last word of the phrase. The second is to consciously extend the phrase, allow oneself to carry on thinking. It's counterintuitive, but it's surprisingly effective. So the sometimes there is this wish for and consent to the power of renunciation, but sometimes you have to be able to help the mind onwards with the wisdom faculty. And it is the wisdom faculty which is the next of the barami. But renunciation is simplification of mind. Simplification makes everything more simple, and it allows us to see the way things are much more clearly and effectively. We feel lighter, we feel brighter, and we feel a confidence to recognize that that without attachment to the enjoyments of memory and imagination and so on, we actually feel better, that we make a profit, we don't lose out in any way. So the wisdom faculty is, as we know, wisdom is considered to be the heart of the Buddhist path, as it were. Now, on the level of thinking, wise reflection, there are two main kinds of wise reflection which we develop in practice. One is the reflection, the thinking, which seeks to replace a negative mental state, negative emotion, an unwholesome emotion with wholesome emotion. And the second is the reflection which seeks to penetrate the nature of reality, in particularly the three characteristics. So in this division of wise reflection, we can see a parallel to the idea of samatha and vipassana. To say certain ways of thinking and reflecting are aiming at particular emotional effect. Others are more directly targeting our avijja, or our false perception, false understanding of the way things are. The first kind, in other words, dealing with craving, and the second kind with avijja. So the first kind of wise reflection which we develop is of many forms. Those you may be familiar with are, in the case that the mind is full of negativity, then we're developing reflections to encourage the arising of loving kindness, forgiveness. When the mind is full with very sensual thoughts, completely obsessing the mind, then we develop wise reflection on the unattractive nature of the human body. You see, if you may find that there is nobody there, no matter how attractive, how beautiful, how handsome, that we cannot find a non-beautiful or a non-handsome feature. So instead of allowing the mind to dwell unrestrainedly on the the beautiful, handsome, attractive feature, we simply shift the focus and dwell upon, reflect upon one of the unattractive features. And learning to think and to reflect and to investigate in such a way as to give rise to loving kindness, compassion, forgiveness when the mind is boiling with aversion and resentment is a development of wisdom faculty, the ability to reflect on the unattractive aspects of the physical body in such a way as to arrest the passion of the mind dwelling from dwelling on the attractive and interesting aspects of physical bodies. These are life skills that we need to develop, paramis. Dwelling on death is a very good technique for reducing laziness. The second kind of wise reflection is that aimed most particularly at observing the way things are, the impermanent, uncertain nature of experience, particularly focusing on the five khandhas, the uncertain, impermanent nature of the body, of feelings, perceptions, mental formations and consciousness. But in daily life, bringing this perception of minor, of uncertainty and unreliability to bear on the things that happen around us, the things that we watch on the news, the things that occur in society at large, bringing our minds to bear on the dukkha inherent in the unenlightened human condition. If you're sitting on a bus or on public transport, then we can do that, develop dukkha sanya, very simply by just observing the way that people have to be constantly shifting their posture to reduce and eliminate dukkha. So every single movement we're making, shifting from side to side, is an attempt to escape from dukkha. So we can do some interesting investigations of nature of physical dukkha while we're sitting in a bus or a train or in public transport. The anatta reflection, one was seeing that there's no owner here, there's nobody standing behind experience, being able to see the way that all phenomena arise and pass away according to causes and conditions. This is should be a constant reflection. You say, why, oh why should it be like, well, because there are, why not? Because there are causes and conditions which have led up to this present phenomena and which are sustaining it. Being able to see things in terms of causes and conditions allows us to make wise choices because we can start to discriminate between those causes and conditions which are amenable to correction or to encouragement, and those causes and conditions which are outside of our control and which we need to simply accept. Lacking that wisdom, we may find ourselves accepting things that should be amended and trying to abandon things which should be accepted. It's through this clear penetration and reflection on the causal nature of phenomena that we are able to respond appropriately and wisely in different situations. So wisdom on that level of developing anicca-saccha, sanya, the perception of impermanence, the perception of dukkha, the perception of anatta. These are creating habits and creating an affinity with and a familiarity with the three characteristics which will stand one in very good stead as the mind becomes more peaceful through meditation and can be turned to investigating the three characteristics on a non-verbal level. So we develop this practice of anicca sanya, dukkha sanya, anatta sanya. It's developing the perception of the three characteristics. This is not vipassana in itself, but it's creating pathways, it's creating a way into the non-verbal recognition, cognition of the three characteristics. Wisdom is generally dealt with three categories of wisdom, often spoken of Buddhist tradition. Wisdom that comes from listening and studying, wisdom that comes from thinking about things we've heard and studied, and the wisdom that comes from meditation. The more we look at our minds, and the more we understand ourselves, the more we understand the human condition. In meditation, we're like the guinea pigs. We're the representatives of the human race, which we have the most immediate access to. But if you can develop insight into the way that greed and jealousy and hatred and so on and so forth appear in your mind, then you know how they appear in the human mind, because these are universal characteristics. The more you understand how the positive qualities arise, then the more you understand other people. So empathy arising through this kind of insight. So when you know how the mind works, and you know how through meditating you get some very interesting information about the way that defilements work, which is why this idea that spiritual people or meditators are kind of wishy-washy or good, but they're not so smart as people who are unscrupulous and evil, which is a very common idea in Thailand. The more you understand, look at your mind, the more you understand defilement, the more you understand human defilement. There are many of this wisdom tales and stories from ancient times which exemplify. There's a story of an emperor in China, and something was stolen from some jewels, or I can't remember. And all the investigations failed to reveal who had stolen the jewels, but it was definitely someone in the palace. So the emperor had all the people in the palace come into the large assembly room, and so we have to do the test with the magic bell. Now there's a bell behind this curtain here, and everybody has to form into single file and walk behind this curtain and touch the bell. And if the person is of impure morality, is a thief, the bell will ring. And if the person is pure, it will not. All you have to do is go and put your hand on the bell. So everybody files past the bell, and no sound. So everyone assuming, well, that didn't work, that was a good idea. But in fact, the emperor was very wise, because he had everyone stand in a line and show them their hand, because the bell had been coated with some grease. So everybody who was pure and innocent didn't have any fear that this bell would emit an incriminating sound. So they put their hand on the bell, and their hand were covered in grease. But the thief, of course, afraid that if he put his hand on the bell, this magic bell would make noise, and being concealed by a curtain, didn't put his hand. So he was the only one whose hand had no grease on it. So this was how the wise emperor discovered who was the thief. So this is just a simple understanding of the nature of guilt, the nature of the human mind applied to solving a problem. Okay, that's an illustrative story. And I'm not going to get through all 10. If you get fed up, just start yawning and I'll sort of pick up on it and stop talking. Okay, the next one is patient endurance, and I've talked about this yesterday, the supreme incinerator of defilements. And there's a famous folk hero in Thailand called Sri Tononchai, and he once went to Sanam Luang, the big area in front of the Grand Temple in Bangkok, and the king of Thailand had announced a big competition to see who could summarize the teachings of Buddhism most concisely, most brilliantly. So monks and sages from all over Thailand came and they got up on the Dhamma seat and they gave their expositions of the heart of Buddhism. And so Sri Tononchai came up and he says, Namo Tassa Bhagavato, and he did all this. And then he said, patient endurance, patient endurance, patient endurance. Evangomi doipakara chani. It was just the way you end Dhamma talks in front of the king. And he won the prize. Okay. So, throughout the Buddhist tradition, and most people assume that Ajahn Chah was always giving these wonderfully wise teachings. He's walking along with his walking stick and then he turns and he smiles and he says something incredible. But in fact, that was very rarely the case. And most of his Dhamma talks were quite repetitive and were bound up with kind of things I was talking last night about Kor Wat, Patimat, monastic regulations and how to use them in development of mindfulness and so on. And the phrase, first, you know, when I was first in time, I didn't understand how you hear Dhamma talk all the time. Otton, otton, otton. You know, so what does that word mean? So it was very much what Ajahn Chah was stressing almost more than anything else. You have the mindfulness of something, this is wholesome, that's unwholesome. But if you never develop the ability to withstand the siren call, the temptation of defilement with patient endurance, then that moment of mindfulness is wasted because it's submerged with the mental state of enjoyment or obsession or whatever. So being able to peacefully coexist with the unpleasant, to be able to not to grit your teeth, but just to endure patiently, to just to be with things that you don't like. And suddenly you realize you don't have to get so hot and bothered and flustered and oppressed and depressed because things aren't going your way or things aren't what you like them to be. But although in certain circumstances you can't do anything about the unpleasant event, you do have the capacity not to buy into it, not to take it so seriously. It's just like this. It's all right. I can deal with this. So it's often when, you know, what the critical factor is where you have this voice in your mind, I can't take this anymore. I've had enough. It's too much. It's too much, you know. Often all you have to do is just to say, why? Are you sure? No, it's not. I can deal with this. It's all right. So learning how to talk to yourself intelligently, is also a support of wisdom, a support of patient endurance. And patient endurance is not always the right thing. Sometimes you shouldn't be patient. Sometimes you should say no, or change what you're doing. It's just not the right thing. So patient endurance always needs to be supported by wisdom. Wirya, effort. Wirya, the word wirya comes from wira, means hero. It's a heroic effort. Four kinds of effort. Effort to protect the mind against unwholesome factors which have not yet arisen. In the case in which we're unsuccessful, unwholesome factors have arisen. Putting forth the effort to abandon those unwholesome dhammas and factors. Putting forth the effort to give rise to wholesome dhammas, and putting forth the effort to care for, nurture, and bring to maturation wholesome dhammas that have already arisen. Four kinds of effort, and these are essential in every area of practice, and in daily life, and in life in the world. An ability just to constantly put forth effort in a very patient way. So these two go together, and it's this constancy, continuity of effort. I'll tell you another story. Okay, this is a Thai story. It's about this lady and her daughter-in-law going out to collect mushrooms. In Thailand, when the rain falls, everyone's out in the forest collecting mushrooms for the evening curry. And this young woman, the daughter-in-law, knew a particular spot up on the hill where there were mushrooms that grow in great abundance. And she was determined to make as fast progress as she could to get to this particular field on the hill, and just to gather up all these mushrooms into a bag and go back home and make a curry. Her mother-in-law had a different idea. As they're walking along, she see a mushroom by the side of the road, and she stopped. And her daughter-in-law, frustrated, said, Mum, come on. We've got to get up to that field up there. There's hundreds of mushrooms up there. There's just one mushroom there, just a single mushroom. Don't waste your time. And the way that, you know, that relationships between mother-in-laws and daughter-in-laws go, she didn't pay any attention. She got a single mushroom. And they go a bit further on, and, oh, no, she stopped again. And it's just one single mushroom, and we're never going to get there. In the end, the young woman just got completely fed up. She said, I'm going on ahead. So she got up to the field, and of course she wasn't the only one who had that kind of idea. And she got up there, and there were no mushrooms left. And so she trudged her way back to the village, getting to the village in the evening, and she goes past the house, and her mother-in-law is in the kitchen, and there's this wonderful aroma. And she says, Mum, what's that wonderful smell? And her mother-in-law says, it's single mushroom curry. So she got a mushroom here and a mushroom there and a mushroom there, and she got enough to make a beautiful dish, where the person who thought, you know, all or nothing, you know, sort of jhana or nothing, mushrooms or nothing, you know, was disappointed. So it's a matter of, you know, just this very modest but constant effort. It's not just, you know, putting a great deal of effort in and then, now I deserve a rest. This kind of work and holiday attitude to spiritual practice doesn't work. But it's constantly just a single mushroom here and there, and you'll get something very nice to eat. Next is satya. Satya means truthfulness. And of all the bodhisattva, over all his lifetimes of accumulating barami before being born, his last life as Prince Siddhartha, he failed in almost in all of the paramis in one life or another. The one parami that he never betrayed or never fell away from was such a parami. So truthfulness. Now, a lot of people say truthfulness all very well, but, you know, what about white lies, you know? But this is the point. This is why sila and the external practices are meditations in themselves. They're liberations. Because the question is, it's not, should I tell the truth or should I hurt that person's feelings? No, the point is, how can I avoid hurting that person's feelings without telling a lie? So you have to use your intelligence. Truthfulness, you're freeing yourself, you're liberating yourself from falsity. And someone who speaks truly is someone whose word is given great respect and has real weight. And one of the things that attracted me to Buddhist monastic order is I felt that the monks that I met from the very beginning, when I first met Ajahn Sumedho in Hampstead in 78, and these are monks that practice what they preach. They're true, they're sincere in what they're doing. And that's a wonderful quality to develop and to free oneself of, as well, should I tell the truth or not? Or maybe it's too... Because once you admit the idea of white lies, that you will, under certain circumstances, maybe say something that's not true in order to hurt their feelings, you open a can of worms, because the way the mind works, it becomes an excuse, and often it covers over defilements of mind. You're just not brave enough to say something that needs to be said, or whatever. So the practice of truthfulness is a real liberation and a purification of the mind. Adhittana is very good if you're a doubter. If you're like, oh, shall I do this or shall I do that? I've got another story. This is from Iran. This is about this old man. Muslims had these really long beards, especially old men. And this old man was with his grandson. And his grandson said, Granddad, when you're asleep, is your beard outside the blanket or inside the blanket? And he couldn't answer. So that night, he lay down to sleep, and he says, it's out. No, it doesn't feel quite right. So he put it inside. He put it inside. No, I don't think that's it either. So he put it outside. So he didn't get any sleep all night. So he ended up cutting off his beard in the morning. But that, the way that the mind, doubting mind, works, it's like that. So a way to cut this off is to make vows. If you make vow that's too difficult and you can't keep it, then you're going to feel hopeless and be discouraged. You make a vow too easy, you're not going to have any sense of accomplishment. Playing a sport. You play tennis with someone who's much better than you and you get beaten 6-love, 6-love. That's hopeless. You don't want to do that anymore. But if you win 6-love, 6-love, that's not very enjoyable either. I'm speaking to someone who's never played tennis in my life, but I'm just assuming that that's the case. So if you play with someone who's just a bit better than you, you find actually you're playing better than you thought you could. Somehow their slight superiority brings forth something within you that you didn't realize that you had. And this is what happens when you make intelligent vows. Now, as a Buddhist monk, it's like being born and dying, it's kind of difficult to get born, it takes a long time, but it's very easy to die. It can happen any moment very easily. So it's very easy to, it's very difficult to become a monk, but it's very easy to leave. You don't have, even have this sort of ceremony or anything. All you have to do to leave the monkhood is to say, I've had enough. And for somebody to understand what you said. If you said it to someone who didn't speak English, you'd be all right. But if they understood what you're saying, that's it. You're no longer a monk. Very easy. So you can imagine that it's very, you know, whenever you get some kind of difficulty, you think, just throw it all in. You know, I've had enough. You don't make any lifetime vows. But that kind of doubt and irresolution can torture the minds of young monastics. So as teachers, we often recommend to make a vow for 5 years or 3 years. To say, well, look, just forget about the possibility of leaving and doing something else and giving up on this for a certain period of time, 3 years or 5 years, and then decide. So it clarifies the mind, it focuses the mind, and it gives energy to the mind. And you find that by cutting off that doubt and irresolution, you access some real energy. Liberation from doubt and irresolution and confusion. The practice of metta, obviously, is a liberation from anger and aversion, and it makes the mind bright and happy. And I was very, very impressed reading, it's a book, a history book, about an event apparently happened in a war between Sweden and Denmark. And after the battle was over, this Swedish soldier, as I remember, was more or less unharmed, slightly injured, and people were groaning and moaning all around. And there was a Danish soldier just over here who was in pain. He was, water. And the Swedish soldier felt really sorry for him, and he had a water flask or a water container. And as he bent over the Danish soldier to give him some water, the Danish soldier realized it was a Swede, and he got to get hold of his knife, and he's going to knife him. And he's going to help him, give him some water, and the guy's going to knife him, but he catches his arm and disarms this Danish soldier. And he says, look, out of the goodness of my heart, I was going to... I came to help you, and you repay me by trying to kill me. So I'm going to punish you. I was originally going to give you all of the flask of water. Now I'm only going to give you half, and I'm going to keep half for myself. So that was his revenge. You know, instead of giving all of the water, he just give a little half of it and keep some for himself. So that's wonderful metta, isn't it? So the point about metta is that it doesn't discriminate. So if you have metta for someone you love, that's not hard. Metta for the people who have the same beliefs as you do, the same political persuasion, the same color shirt, the same group, the same country, but not for other coloured shirts or countries or whatever, then that's not metta. It's completely non-discriminatory. That's a wonderful uplift of the mind, just this wishing well. Now, what happens if people really behave badly, you know, and really nasty, you know? Well, if you think metta means, you know, it's this kind of Pollyanna kind of love everybody, maybe, you know, you think, well, I can't do that, it's impossible. I mean, he's just a really bad, nasty person. So does that mean that you can't or you shouldn't have metta? No. What it means is that you have to recognize that metta means wishing others well. So what does that mean? Well, you can wish for others to be free of anger and enmity and hatred and the desire for revenge. You can wish for people to recognize that they're creating bad karma and to abandon their unwholesome actions. So even the most, if we use our reflective ability, we can see that there is always a way in which we can wish others well, even if it's simply the level of abandoning the unwholesome actions, which are, you know, you say, the law of karma says that people who do bad actions, you know, have bad results. You know, that person's doing so many bad things, they're going to go to hell afterward. It serves them right. Somnam na, at the same time. But then, you know, that's a really black, unwholesome mental state you've invited into your heart. The thing is, what is the skillful way to deal with our feelings towards people who we feel have behaved very badly? Well, metta is always the answer, but the actual form of that metta will depend upon our reflective abilities. So it's something that we, in the end, our responsibility above all is to ourselves, that the moment we allow our mind to dwell in, indulge in anger, we're no longer on the middle path, we're no longer disciples of the Buddha in that particular moment. We've turned our back on the Buddha, we've turned our back on our teachers, we've turned our back on all that we hold most noble and virtuous. So there's no, absolutely no concept of righteous indignation. There's no, absolutely no situation in which anger is a wise or an intelligent response, even to the most awful injustice or violence. It's only when the mind has the wish for the well-being of all that we can find creative responses to the terrible things that go on in our societies and our world. So we have to free ourselves and liberate ourselves from anger and negativity. And metta is the wonderful way of doing this. The last of the barami is upekkha. So we live our lives with... it's very easy to see in children, you know, how what we like and what we don't like are absolutes. You say, no, I'm not going to do that. Why not? I don't like it. And the way the child says, I don't like it, this is absolutely rational reason not to do this. Well, obviously I'm not going to do it. I don't like it. You know, I'm going to do this. Why are you going to do this? I like it. Now, I don't think that adults are really any different, except we're, you know, we can disguise it a lot more. But if you look very closely, I think, why do you, well, I like it, you know. When you're going to do that, well, I don't like it. And the people say, oh, yeah, I just feel so free. And so, why? Well, I can just do whatever I like, you know. And I don't have to do anything I don't like anymore. This is, but that's a very spurious kind of freedom. But the so equanimity means freedom from being compelled to act or not to act by feelings of liking and disliking, maintaining that balance of mind, that equanimity, that evenness of mind. And so in Thai, I often compare it to someone who's going out to plow their fields. You know, on some days it's really, really hot. Some days it's pouring with rain. But if you're a rice farmer, that's kind of irrelevant. You know, you've got to go out there and do your job. You've got to go out there and plow your fields or transplant your rice or whatever. So whereas the recognition that it's very hot or it's cold or it's wet or it's so on, that's there. But it's not a major determinant on on your action. There's recognition of it, but it's just there in the sense of I like this or I don't like that. But the liking and the disliking arising and passing away according to nature, but they're no longer absolutes in our mind. Our minds are not conditioned simply by like and dislike. That may seem straightforward, but I think if we're honest with ourselves, we see how much more of our lives than perhaps we would be proud to admit or willing to admit are guided unnecessarily so by simple liking and disliking. So recognizing the movement, not saying you shouldn't like this and you shouldn't like that, but saying, well, the Buddha saying, the thing that you like, is it really worthy of that like in the way you think it is? You see, if you say, this is wonderful, I want this, I really like this, but no, it's bad, it's wrong, or I'm a Buddhist meditator, or I'm not going. But if the perception of it is basically something that's really worthy of like, then there's a conflict in the mind, and it becomes this kind of Puritan kind of fighting with yourself all the time. But the Buddha says that's the wrong way to go about it. The question, the idea is to investigate whether or not that is really worthy of the feelings of like or dislike that you're attributing to it. And when you look at it more closely, you see that it's not. So there are still remnants and habits of like and dislike, but they've lost their venom, they've lost their sting, they've lost their power over you. And so you're liberated from liking and disliking. So in the practice of creating the foundation, the surroundings, the support for the meditation, these kinds of liberation from stinginess and selfishness and attachment to material things through dana, the liberation from unskillful actions and speech which create remorse and lack of respect and for oneself and create a dislike for oneself or self-loathing even in some unfortunate cases. It's liberated from that, liberated from one's indulgence and complete immersion in the sensual world, liberating from prejudice and irrationality and superficial and incorrect attitudes and thoughts and reflections through wisdom faculty. We are liberating ourselves through just weakness and fear of pain and difficulty and just giving up through patient endurance and putting forth effort, overcoming stagnation and laziness through steady, constant effort, overcoming doubt and its resolution through adhitana, overcoming insincerity and hypocrisy, through satya, overcoming anger, aversion, resentment, through metta, overcoming addiction to feelings of liking, disliking, with upekkha, we create, we sustain, develop ten parami, and create the causes and conditions for the ultimate liberation. So, my apologies for speaking a little bit over the limit this evening, but as I come here, very rarely I hope you'll forgive me. And